Matthew chapter 2 verses 1 through 23. The third talk in a series on the Gospel of Matthew was presented by Ron Julian on March 15, 2015 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2015. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
The Gospel of Matthew tells the story of Jesus, the Christ, the Messiah, the anointed King, who will save his people and bring peace and righteousness to the world. Last week, we began to look at Matthew's portrayal of the birth of Jesus. We saw God acting to bring the Christ into the world by miraculously causing Mary, a virgin, to conceive. We then saw God act to protect that child by speaking to Joseph, who was betrothed to Mary. Joseph had assumed that Mary had been unfaithful and was going to quietly divorce her. But God speaks to Joseph in the first of a number of dreams in this section. God tells Joseph that Mary had not been unfaithful. God himself had caused Mary to conceive, and her son was the promised Messiah who would save his people from their sins. So Joseph then obediently steps up and completes his marriage to Mary. He accepts Mary as his wife, and in so doing, Joseph accepts Jesus as his own son, his legal heir, and this is how it comes about that the genealogy that we read at first was true. Since Joseph is in the royal line of David, that means that Jesus was now also legally in the royal line of David. Thus, we see the first in a number of ways that Joseph steps up to protect the child Jesus. And then we saw Matthew make an interesting and somewhat puzzling comment. He says that this all was to fulfill what the prophet had said, a virgin will conceive and bear a son, and she will call his name Emmanuel, which means God with us. I argued that probably this was not a prediction of the virgin birth of Jesus, although I am still open to arguments that it is. But in any case, what is significant is the name Emmanuel. God was indicating through the name of the child that he would be with his people, and that in fact, one day he was going to send the Messiah to sit on the throne of David and establish justice and peace forever. Well, Jesus is the real Emmanuel. He is the fulfillment of God's promise. He is the Messiah sent to save his people. He is truly God with us, God on our side, God reaching out to save us. Today we're going to continue on with Matthew's birth narrative. Let me explain how we're going to do this. First, I want to read you the rest of the birth narrative, which is chapter 2 of Matthew. Then I want to retell the story in my own words, trying to bring out some things that I think we need to know to understand what Matthew's talking about. And then after I retell the story, I want to step back and look at what Matthew has done in this whole birth narrative. What has he been accomplishing? However, there is one thing that I'm not going to talk about today. I'm going to leave until next week. We looked at the first of four passages where Matthew says that something in Jesus' life fulfilled something in an Old Testament passage. There are three more that we haven't looked at, and I'm going to wait until next week to talk about those passages. Bringing in the Old Testament and explaining what's going on is sort of complicated enough that I'm going to put that on a separate day. So I'm not today going to talk about out of Egypt I called my son. I'm not going to talk about Rachel weeping for her children. And I'm not going to talk about he shall be called a Nazarene. I'm going to talk about those things next week. But for the rest, I want to see if we can get the overall picture of what Matthew is doing in his account of the birth of Jesus. So we're going to start reading in chapter 2 of Matthew. Let me read the whole thing to you. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea In the days of Herod the king, Magi from the east arrived in Jerusalem, saying, Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star in the east and have come to worship him. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Gathering together all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Messiah was to be born. They said to him, In Bethlehem of Judea, for this is what has been written by the prophet, And you, Bethlehem, land of Judah, are by no means least among the leaders of Judah, for out of you shall come forth a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. Then Herod secretly called the Magi and determined from them the exact time the star appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem and said, Go and search carefully for the child, and when you have found him, report to me so that I too may come and worship him. After hearing the king, they went their way, and the star, which they had seen in the east, went on before them until it came and stood over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. After coming into the house, they saw the child with Mary his mother, and they fell to the ground and worshipped him. Then, opening their treasures, they presented to him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned by God in a dream not to return to Herod, the Magi left for their own country by another way. Now, when they had gone, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, Get up, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt, and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to destroy him. So Joseph got up and took the child and his mother while it was still night and left for Egypt. He remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet, Out of Egypt I called my son. Then, when Herod saw that he had been tricked by the Magi, he became very enraged and sent and slew all the male children who were in Bethlehem and all its vicinity from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had determined from the Magi. Then what had been spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, and she refused to be comforted because they were no more. But when Herod died, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, Get up, take the child and his mother, and go into the land of Israel. For those who sought the child's life are dead. So Joseph got up, took the child and his mother, and came into the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning over Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Then, after being warned by God in a dream, he left for the regions of Galilee and came and lived in a city called Nazareth. This was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophets, He shall be called a Nazarene. Okay, so I'd like to retell you this story with a little background and so forth thrown in. Jesus was born in the village of Bethlehem, a few miles away from the city of Jerusalem. Bethlehem was the village where David the king had been born and lived. So Joseph, as a descendant of David, was thus living in his ancestral homeland. I might comment that Matthew does not tell us. What Luke tells us is that Joseph used to live in Nazareth, but he had moved to this region because of a census. After Jesus was born, Joseph decided to continue living with his family in Bethlehem, and they stayed there for many days. We might speculate why Joseph decided to stay. After all, Joseph's adopted son, Jesus, is going to be the promised king in the line of David. Where better for a son of David to grow up than in the village of David? And even better, it is just a few miles down the road from Jerusalem where Jesus is destined to rule. Perhaps Joseph was thinking like that. For whatever reason, Joseph chose to live in Bethlehem for a while. After many days, wise men from the east came looking for the one they called the King of the Jews. They were called Magi. Now, for many centuries, the Magi had been important and influential priests and wise men in the east. Some of them, at times, had great political power. So it is possible that these Magi were in fact important and influential men. We don't exactly know, but it's possible. These Magi were probably coming from the region of what used to be the Babylonian Empire. 500 years earlier, when the prophet Daniel had lived as a captive in Babylon, he became the chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. And you may remember that Daniel was given visions relating to the coming king of the Jews who would rule over all the earth. Some of his visions even seemed to give a kind of timetable for the coming of the Messiah. And so, perhaps, these Magi, coming to Judea looking for the king of the Jews, were familiar with Daniel's visions. At any rate, at the time Jesus was born, there were many Jews living in Babylon. So it is not surprising that the Magi would be familiar with the concept of the Jewish Messiah, the King of the Jews, who would one day rule over all the earth. Now, somehow these wise men had come to recognize that a certain star in the sky was a sign that the king had been born. We don't know what they were thinking. We don't know much about this star at all. Perhaps the star moved as it guided them. It sort of sounds like it did in places. It's a little hard to say. But in fact, they were right. The king of the Jews had been born, and the star led them right to him. God had reached out to these Gentile astrologers, leading them to come and pay homage to the king of not just the Jews, but of all the world. So, if you were looking for the king of the Jews, where would you go? Well, where else would you go but to Jerusalem, where the recently born king presumably will someday reign? At this time, all of Israel was ruled by King Herod. He's usually referred to as Herod the Great. This is to distinguish him from some of his sons, who later ruled in the region and were also called Herod. When Herod the Great heard that these eastern wise men were looking for the newborn king of the Jews, this troubled him greatly. Herod rightly understood that they were talking about the Messiah, the Christ, and as far as Herod is concerned, this is very bad news. Herod was a ruthless and paranoid king, always concerned that someone or other might be plotting to take his throne. The Jewish people did not like him. He was not of Jewish descent. He was an Idumean. He was only king because the Romans established him in power. He looked out for Roman interests. The emperor of Rome, Caesar Augustus, trusted Herod and gave him a lot of power. Herod was always worried, though, that he might lose his throne to a usurper. And as he grew older, he became more and more paranoid. It's possible that he was growing more and more mentally ill as he got old. He once became convinced that one of his wives was plotting against him, so he had her killed. He was convinced that a number of his sons were plotting against him, so he had them killed. The brutal way Herod treated his family was so well known that even the emperor of Rome, Caesar Augustus, joked about it. Caesar joked that he would rather be Herod's pig than Herod's son. And so, to Herod, the paranoid, it was not good news that someone arrives announcing that the Messiah had been born. Now, we don't know how much Herod actually believed about this story, but he obviously did not want people going around saying that the rightful king, the promised son of David, had been born. This could become the nucleus of a movement against his throne. So, the first thing Herod did was to ask his advisors where the Messiah was supposed to be born. And as it happens, the prophets actually answered that question. Micah 5:2 says that the one who would rule Israel would be born in Bethlehem. And that makes sense because that was the home village of David, the king. And the coming king, of course, was going to be a descendant of David. Even the man on the street knew that the Messiah would come from Bethlehem. We read about this in the Gospel of John. In John 7:40, we see the crowds debating who this Jesus is. John says, "Some of the people, therefore, when they heard the words of Jesus, were saying, 'This certainly is the prophet.' Others were saying, 'This is the Christ.' Still others were saying, 'Surely the Christ is not going to come from Galilee, is he? Has not the scripture said that the Christ comes from the descendants of David and from Bethlehem, the village where David was?' So a division occurred in the crowd because of him." So you can see the crowds had this problem. Jesus looked like he might be the Messiah, but if he were the Messiah, the Christ, he was supposed to come from Bethlehem, and yet he was Jesus of Nazareth from Galilee. So the people are arguing about it. Well, Matthew is telling us the story about how this comes about. Matthew's telling us about how Jesus of Nazareth was in fact born in Bethlehem. So anyway, Herod found out that the Messiah was expected to be born in Bethlehem. Herod called the Magi before him secretly. He told them that they should look in Bethlehem. And he said, "When you find him, come back and tell me. I want to worship him too," which of course was a great big lie. And Herod also asked them a question of clarification. "How long ago was it that you first saw this star?" Herod was trying, you see, to calculate how old the child would be now. Later, when Herod sought out the child to kill him, he went looking for male children 2 years and under. So it must have been a while since the birth was first announced to the Magi. This, by the way, is how we know that our nativity scenes we put out at Christmas are wrong. We set up the scene with the shepherds standing next to the Magi, all looking down at the baby Jesus in a manger. But the shepherds and the Magi likely never met. According to Luke, the shepherds came to see Jesus on the day of his birth. They did indeed see him lying in a manger. But the Magi come much later. They didn't see a baby in a manger. They probably saw a toddler. And see him they did. When the Magi left Herod, they were delighted that the star was still guiding them. God was still intervening on their behalf, making sure that their long journey ended with them meeting this King of the Jews. When they got there, it says they worshiped him, which is not a religious expression. It means they prostrated themselves on the ground in submission to the king. It was an act of deference, of recognition that he was superior to them. They presented him kingly gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. His mother probably had to stop him from putting the gold in his mouth. And then God once again intervened by giving a message through a dream. Last week we saw the first time God intervened in this way, when Joseph was told in a dream about the virgin birth of Jesus. This time, the Magi are warned in a dream not to go back to Herod. Because, of course, if they go back to Herod, the whole point was Herod wants to know where the child is. So they're not going to go back to him. They're not going to tell him. They snuck out of town. And now, Joseph also receives a warning dream. In verse 13, it says, "Now when they had gone, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, 'Get up. Take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to destroy him.' Joseph responded to this message immediately, not even waiting for daylight. He awakens his family and they immediately set off for Egypt by night." Now, as we know, Herod had been playing a trick on the Magi. He was pretending to share their enthusiasm for the Messiah, but in fact, he was actually sending them off to be his unwitting spies. They were supposed to come back and tell him where they had found the Messiah. Then Herod was planning to go there immediately and kill the child. When Herod found out that they had tricked him, that they had left without telling him the location of the child, so now he doesn't know which child it is we're dealing with, he was outraged. And since he didn't know where in Bethlehem the child was, he killed all the male children under a certain age. Considering what we know about Herod, this is a very believable story. Killing possible threats to his throne is what Herod did with sickening regularity. Outside the Bible, history does not record this particular massacre of the children, but that is not necessarily surprising. Bethlehem was a small village. There were probably not many children killed. Of course, all children are important, but considering all the other terrible things Herod did, the death of these children was not noticed by history. Joseph, having left for Egypt, kept his family there for a while, until one night he had another revelation from God in a dream. An angel told him, "Get up, take the child and his mother, and go into the land of Israel, for those who sought the child's life are dead." And so Joseph took Jesus and Mary back into Israel. Now, it seems that Joseph's intention was to go back to the Bethlehem area. And again, just speculating, this was his ancestral homeland, and it was very close to Jerusalem. He might very well have thought that this would be the appropriate place to raise Jesus, the king of the Jewish people. But when Joseph returned to Israel, he checked out the new political situation. Okay, yes, Herod the Great was now dead. His kingdom had been split into several parts. Judea was now under the control of Herod's son Archelaus. And Archelaus seems to have had a bad reputation. Joseph was afraid to go back to Judea. And Joseph was right to be afraid, as it turns out. Archelaus turns out to be such a tyrant that ultimately the people revolted and the Romans kicked Archelaus out. He was a terrible ruler of the region. That is why later, when Jesus was a man, Judea was ruled by a Roman governor, Pontius Pilate, not a king descended from Herod. Herod's son Archelaus was so bad that he had been removed as ruler decades before Jesus started his ministry. So anyway, at this time, in Jesus' infancy, we see that Joseph was afraid to live in a region controlled by Archelaus, and God confirmed these fears by giving Joseph another dream, this time warning him not to go back to Judea. So Joseph went instead to a little town in Galilee called Nazareth. Galilee was also controlled by a son of Herod the Great. This was a different region now, but it was controlled by Herod Antipas, not by Archelaus. We will read about him later in Matthew. But evidently, Herod Antipas was not as much of a tyrant as Archelaus, and so Joseph took his family to Galilee. Matthew doesn't tell us this, but in fact, Galilee is where Joseph used to live. He may have thought it desirable to live in Judea for the sake of his son, but since it was too dangerous, Joseph returned to his original home in Nazareth in Galilee. Okay, this is the basic story that Matthew has told us. What I would like to do now is I would like to step back and try to trace some themes and ideas that are running through this story. I'm going to try to sort of give you a picture of what I think Matthew is doing. I have commented before that it is clear that Matthew has very much shaped his gospel and controlled where he puts things and the impact that they have. This is very obvious in the birth narrative. Matthew's birth narrative is a great literary construction. It is very carefully shaped with repetition, foreshadowing, and allusions to numerous Old Testament stories. It is so carefully constructed that many skeptics see it as basically fiction. Matthew is a great storyteller, but only a great storyteller. He has taken hints and allusions from the Old Testament and woven together a beautiful but fictional narrative. Well, I think that's the wrong answer. I don't think that's what Matthew is doing. There is no doubt that Matthew is a literary craftsman. He has woven together a complicated story with intertwining repetitions and allusions. But I think that Matthew has told his story in this way because he believes that God is the master storyteller. The birth of Jesus is a story told by God. And God has constructed that story in such a way that it is filled with repetitions and foreshadowings and allusions. Matthew has crafted his story to bring out what he sees as the inherent meaning of these events. At any rate, that's the choice in front of us. Matthew is clearly a constructed thing. The question is, why is it constructed like that? And my belief is Matthew is trying to reflect what he sees as the various strands that God has woven together into this story. So I don't know if I'm going to convince you of that case, but let me see what I can do. Let's start with the activity of God as it is portrayed in the story. It has been hundreds of years since God spoke through the prophets, through visions and dreams and miracles. But now God is intervening in history once again. God miraculously causes a virgin girl, Mary, to conceive a son. God gives a dream to Joseph, explaining the virgin birth and telling him the importance of Mary's son, the promised Messiah. God arranges for Jesus to be born in Bethlehem, according to prophecy. God arranges things so pagan wise men have a star to guide them to see the Messiah. God gives the wise men a dream to warn them from returning to Herod. God gives more dreams to Joseph to cause him to flee to Egypt, to bring Jesus back from Egypt, and to send him to Nazareth. As we might expect, from beginning to end, God is playing an active, supernatural part in the story of Christ's birth. And in the midst of this story, we see the important protective role that God gives Joseph to play. For Matthew tells the story to bring out the crucial role that Joseph plays. In many ways, this is Joseph's story, as Matthew tells it. Joseph chooses not to divorce Mary. Joseph therefore gives her son legitimacy as an heir of David. Joseph protects the child from Herod by taking him to Egypt. Joseph brings the child back to his people, the people of Israel. And yet Joseph chooses not to live in Judea, but rather takes that child to live in Galilee, which will have great ramifications in our story. We also see that Matthew is deliberately, I think, telling a story about geography. As we saw in the Gospel of John, the crowds didn't know what to do with Jesus. The Messiah was supposed to be born in Bethlehem, according to prophecy, and yet Jesus was clearly a Galilean. So Matthew tells this interesting geographical story of the origins of the Christ. He is born in Bethlehem. This is very important because prophecy says he would be born in Bethlehem. Joseph then takes the child to Egypt. As we will talk about later, Egypt is a place with great significance in the history of the Jews. For God to bring his son to Egypt and then out again resonates with the rest of salvation history. And then finally, Joseph takes the child to Galilee, to Nazareth. As we have discussed before, Galilee is looked down on by the Jews in Judea, and Nazareth is a little village with no importance even in Galilee. In John chapter 1, Nathanael is told that Jesus of Nazareth is the promised Messiah. Now, Nathanael is himself a resident of Galilee, and yet even he remarks, "Can any good thing come out of Nazareth?" Even to a Galilean, Nazareth is nothing special. Nazareth is an insignificant village far away from the center of Jewish life in Jerusalem. And this becomes a very significant part of the story Matthew tells. As I mentioned before, the gospel is structured to portray Jesus' life as a journey from Galilee to Jerusalem. So the geography is important. The Christ is born in Bethlehem. He retreats to Egypt and then comes out again, and finally ends up in Nazareth in Galilee, where his ministry will be portrayed as beginning. Also, Matthew portrays the birth of Jesus as simultaneously a big deal and not a big deal. On the one hand, this is clearly a monumentally important event. God causes a virgin to miraculously conceive a son. This is the unique, most important human being in the history of the world, and he has a unique birth. We don't really know what the significance of the virgin birth is. We're not told what exactly is going on or why it was done that way, but it is obvious there is no other human being like Jesus. God himself has intervened to bring him about in a way that has not happened with any other human being in history or ever would. Joseph is told that Jesus is the promised king who will save his people from their sins. Matthew explains the process by which Jesus gains a legitimate place in the line of David through Joseph. Jesus is born in Bethlehem, just as the prophet had predicted. Gentile wise men travel a great distance by supernatural guidance by God in order that they can come to Jesus and pay homage to him, bearing extraordinary gifts. This guy's a big deal. You got people coming from the other side of the world, sort of, to see this kid. There is this theme that runs through the story about God giving revelatory dreams. God constantly intervenes on Jesus' behalf by telling Joseph and the Magi what they need to know to protect the child Jesus. All of these things are extraordinary. This is an extraordinary story that we are told here. And yet, at the same time, Matthew also makes it clear that the birth of the promised king of the Jews is in many ways marked with failure and unimportance. His birth may be miraculous, but it opens his mother up to charges of immorality, and the child is in danger of being seen as illegitimate, a truly serious failing in this culture. Joseph's acceptance of Mary and Jesus is what rescues an otherwise shameful situation. Given that Jesus is the rightful king of all creation, surprisingly few people know anything about his birth. Herod didn't know. When the Magi show up announcing the birth of the Messiah, nobody seems to know what's going on. First we've heard of it. The passionate interest of the Magi, these pagan Gentile wise men, astrologers from far away, is in contrast with the indifference of Herod and his advisors. Herod saw nothing but a threat. His advisors don't seem to be interested enough to actually go with the Magi to find the Messiah for themselves. They hear an announcement that the Messiah is born. They give their verdict on, well, it says he'd be in Bethlehem, and then they stay home. Now, in their defense, it is quite possible that they were terrified of Herod and what he might do, and they decided to just stay out of the whole thing. But Herod, the ruler of the Jewish people, tries to kill Jesus. Joseph has to sneak the child out of town. A number of children die because of Jesus. The promised Messiah has come, but he can't even live with his own people in the land of Israel because his life has been threatened, so he has to live in Egypt, away from the very people he came to save. And finally, Jesus ends up living in a hole-in-the-wall village far from the religious center of Jerusalem. In many ways, Jesus doesn't look like much of a big deal at all. Finally, and this is the most controversial part of what I'm going to say, this is a little different from me. This may sound different than the sort of thing that I usually talk about, because it is different than the sort of thing that I usually talk about, but I'm convinced that something like this is going on. So you'll just have to forgive me for being weird, because I'm about to get weird. Matthew tells his story in such a way that he brings out the resonance of these events with things in the Old Testament. And let me say it up front again, I believe that Matthew believes that God arranged things so that this resonance would be there. Matthew didn't create these allusions and foreshadowings, God did. I'm going to list some things that seem plausible to me. It is possible that I am mistaken and Matthew does not intend all of these things. There may be other things that he intends that I have missed. But I would be very surprised if he doesn't intend a significant number of the things that I'm about to talk about. So just forgive me as I get weird. I'm going to pull some out at random. I can't help noticing that Joseph has a namesake in the Old Testament, one of the 12 children of Jacob who founded the Jewish nation. The Old Testament Joseph ends up saving his family, the founders of the Jewish nation, by taking them to Egypt. And partly how God accomplishes that is by giving the Old Testament Joseph revelatory dreams. Joseph, the father of Jesus, saves the child, the hope of the Jewish people, by taking him to Egypt. And God accomplishes this by giving him revelatory dreams. While the Jews are in Egypt, after Joseph had taken them there, a deliverer is born who will ultimately lead the Jewish people out of bondage. This is Moses, better known as Charlton Heston. But Moses' life is threatened at birth because an oppressive ruler decides to kill all the male children, just as the Messiah's life is later threatened by an oppressive ruler, Herod, who decides to kill all the male children. Later in his life, Moses must flee from the land where his people live and live apart from them because the rulers are trying to kill him. But later, God comes to him and tells him it is okay for him to return. When God comes to Moses and tells him he can return, he says, "For all the men who were seeking your life are dead." Just as Jesus' father, Joseph, is told that he can bring the child back to Israel, "For those who sought the child's life are dead." There is a resonance between Moses and Israel in the Exodus and the life of the Messiah, Jesus. No wonder that Matthew says that Jesus' life fulfilled the Old Testament passage, "Out of Egypt I called my son," which I'm going to talk about next week. That passage is talking about Israel and the Exodus. The story of the Magi has a certain resonance as well. Once before, a foreign dignitary came to pay homage to the king of Israel. We read about this in 1 Kings chapter 10. "Now when the queen of Sheba heard about the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, she came to test him with difficult questions. So she came to Jerusalem with a very large retinue, with camels carrying spices and very much gold and precious stones." Later, the prophet Isaiah looks forward to the glorious day of the Messiah. He pictures treasures flowing in from the nations in terms very reminiscent of the Queen of Sheba. This is Isaiah describing the future, the time of the Messiah, the time of the great redemption of Israel. "Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord has risen upon you. Nations will come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your rising. The wealth of the nations will come to you. A multitude of camels will cover you, the young camels of Midian and Ephah. All those from Sheba will come. They will bring gold and frankincense and will bear good news of the praises of the Lord." Now, these Old Testament passages are not a prediction that the Magi were going to come to Jesus and bring gold and frankincense and spices, myrrh, and so forth. But in the light of those passages, the story of the Magi takes on even more significance. God has promised that what he is going to do through the Messiah, the promised king, is so profound that the nations will bring their tribute of gold and spices, just as earlier the Queen of Sheba had brought tribute of gold and spices to the king of Israel. And so in the Magi, we see a foreshadowing, an introductory echo of the day when all the nations will bring tribute to Jesus, the King of the Jews. The city of Bethlehem is the birth town of David the king, but it also has certain tragic connotations as well. Matthew brings this out when he says that the massacre of the children fulfills the passage, "Rachel is weeping for her children." Again, we will talk about that next week. But again, there is a certain resonance to the story that I think Matthew is going to bring out for us. We saw last week that Isaiah spoke of a young woman who would have a son, and that his name would point to the ultimate salvation that God promised his people, the name Emmanuel, God with us. Well, that resonates mightily with the young virgin who had a son whose name also pointed to the ultimate salvation that God promised his people. But in this case, it is not just Jesus' name that is significant. He himself is the promised salvation. He himself is God with us, God coming to his people to save them. The resonance between Isaiah and the birth of Jesus is so strong that we see it reflected in the language of the story. Matthew tells us what the Isaiah passage says: she will bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which means God with us. This is echoed in the language used by the angel who announces the birth of Jesus to Joseph. She shall bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. The language of the angel and the language of Matthew's quotation of Isaiah resonate with each other. Both say, she shall bear a son. Both say, you shall call his name something significant, either Emmanuel or Jesus. And both give an explanation of what the name means. Each element of the story resonating with others. Even the fact that Jesus lives in Nazareth resonates with the Old Testament. Because, as Matthew says, this fulfills what the prophet said, he shall be called a Nazarene. And we will talk about that next week as well. You may recall me telling you that there is no passage in the Old Testament that says he shall be called a Nazarene. So that will be an interesting explanation. Okay, so I hope that I have made my point. You may think that I have gone quite wacko. It's not my intention to go wacko. Grant me at least this. Matthew has given a great deal of attention to carefully crafting his story. But I think that reflects his belief that God has carefully crafted this story. It is God who is the ultimate author. The story of the insignificant birth of Jesus, which was also the most important birth in the history of the world. Matthew has told his story with great care, weaving and interweaving various themes together because he thinks that's the way God has told the story himself. Okay, well, we started quite early today, so we have a lot of time to leave early if you want to, or you can ask me questions or make comments.
Ron, any idea how long they remained in Egypt before they returned back to Israel?
Well, they came back after the death of Herod, and it all depends on how you understand the dating of the time, but I have heard many people propose that Jesus was born around 6 BC and Herod died around 4 BC or something like that, if I'm remembering the dates right. So that would give it, he would have been in the Bethlehem area for a while till the Magi showed up, and then they went to Egypt. So probably not all that long, would seem like, but I'm not. My experience with dating issues is that you read some scholar and they explain how all the dates work and you go, oh, that sounds plausible. And then you forget about it and think, okay, now I know how the dates work. And then you find another person who comes along and writes on it, and they say something plausible that's totally different than what the last guy said. So I've studied those things enough to have confident beliefs about how the dating works, but probably something like that.
When, I'm not sure if this is my question or a question I'm hearing from a different crowd, but when you talk about Matthew writing in a literary form, it immediately begins to sound like, well, then that's not inspired. That's just history. In fact, it's not history. It's a play that he's writing. And so I see, when I hear you say this, I hear you saying Matthew's all swept up in these incredible coincidences between the history of his people and the history of this man, Jesus. And he's sort of saying, how could you miss this, right? God did this, and then God did this, and then God did that, and God did this. And is it, see, it's all laid out for us, which also may have some of its own problems. Mm-hmm. But when talk about reading an inspired book or letter and seeing a form that you would also read like in a novel or a movie script, whatever, makes people nervous. So can you kind of address that?
Yeah. Well, we have to step back and think about what we mean by the inspiration of the Bible at all. Because actually, that thing that's making people nervous is actually true of everything that we read in the Bible. That is, except for a few, there are no exceptions. So let me just say, so let's take the letter to the Romans. It has the form that it does because Paul is writing a letter into a situation where he's trying to accomplish certain purposes. So the form that that takes, it's not highly literary, but it has a form that arises out of a purpose that the human being Paul has in trying to get his point across to other human beings. The exception I was going to talk about is that there are some parts of the prophets that claim to be, this is God speaking directly. And I'm not challenging that claim, but even there, it gets sort of tricky because God is speaking directly in the same sort of poetic parallelism that the prophet has been writing in up to that point. So the prophet is writing a poem, and when God comes along and starts talking, he speaks like he's talking in rhyme. It's not really rhyme, but if you can imagine a prophet writing a prophecy in rhyme, and when God starts talking, he's talking in rhyme too. Okay, how do I understand what exactly is going on there? I have this problem everywhere. The idea of the inspiration of the Bible, thus, is not God has come along and said to Paul, don't bother writing that letter, let me tell you what to say. Paul really writes a letter. And likewise, Matthew looks at this story and says, I want to tell this story, and I'm going to choose my language in such a way that certain things are highlighted. I'm going to leave certain parts out. I'm going to emphasize certain things by the things that I have chosen to bring out in the story and so forth. What we're claiming is that the choices that Matthew has made in what and how he is trying to communicate has given us the truth. But everything that we have in the Bible arises from the choices of the authors who have written it down. Jesus tells parables. Parables are fictional stories that he tells in order to make a point. But it's not a problem. The fact that the unjust judge or the good Samaritan or whoever might not have actually lived, that doesn't affect us. So I don't think this should affect us either. Now, what could affect us, I am recognizing that there's a way that you could go that would say the structured nature, the repetitions and the allusions and so forth that we find in there, those are from Matthew. Matthew is saying, hey, wouldn't it be cool if I told this story and I brought in this kind of thing? And look at how, remember how it happened that the Pharaoh tried to kill the male children and Moses had to be rescued from that? I know, I'll tell a story about how Herod tried to kill the male children and Jesus had to be rescued from that. And so it's a fictional construction that Matthew has come up with in order to bring in these elements. And there are many people who have argued that that's what he did. They would argue these four passages that I've talked about where he says, this fulfilled what happened back here. Why does Matthew tell a story about a virgin birth? Because he's got a passage in Isaiah that says, the virgin will conceive and bear a son, and they'll call his name Emmanuel. That's where he gets his idea. I'm going to tell a story that I can use that as the background for. Why does he tell the story about Jesus going to Egypt? Because he wants to appeal to the passage in Hosea that says, out of Egypt I called my son. So the passages exist, and Matthew makes up a story to be able to use those passages in the way he wants. Many people would argue that. Many somewhat skeptical scholars, and maybe some of them even not so skeptical, who think, look, it's so constructed, it's so neat and put together in many ways that it must be an artificial creation. It must be something that Matthew has done to make his story really nifty. And what I'm saying is that I don't think that's right, but that his careful craftsmanship and the way he's put it together has not changed the fact that he is telling the story of what God did. In fact, the way he's telling the story, I think, indicates that he has a certain view of how God has told this story and what it all adds up to. So yeah, there's a problem there. There's something we have to confront. What is it that Matthew's doing? I told you that from my perspective as a teacher, teaching Matthew is like you put the part where you have to climb Mount Everest right at the front, because teaching through the first two chapters of Matthew, from my perspective, is the hardest part of this whole thing. I'm working really hard on trying to get this stuff together. You cannot imagine how much time I spent trying to get this stupid talk together. It is so difficult to figure out what do you talk about and how do you explain all of this stuff. So from my perspective, I know a lot of people would say, oh, the Sermon on the Mount is so difficult, or oh, you know. From my perspective, we get to that, that's a piece of cake. I mean, we can start talking about Jesus' teaching and I can explain to you what it is he's saying. That's easy to do. This is not easy to talk about, I don't think, or figure out exactly what's going on. But I'm seeing it the way I have described it, that I think it is clear that Matthew has been very deliberate, that he sees a lot of things going on here, and that he has put things together to bring out certain things. And this is not, my contention is, I'm not making this stuff up. I'm not imposing something on what Matthew's doing. He clearly is doing something like this. Everybody recognizes that Matthew's doing something here. I may have gotten it wrong in details as to what it is he's doing, but something like this is going on, I think. It seems fairly obvious. But what's the significance of that? What does it mean? Does it mean that this is just a crafted story and nothing else? And I'm saying, no, I don't think so. I think both Matthew and Luke agree on the general outline of things, that Jesus was born in Bethlehem and he was born of Mary, who was a virgin who conceived by the power of the Holy Spirit. I mean, this is, they both have that same story to tell, but Matthew brings out certain things in the way that he chooses to tell that story, which doesn't mean that it didn't happen, but it does mean that he is being a writer. He is choosing to tell this story in a certain way. I feel comfortable with that. I think that both of those things can be true, that he is crafting a story, but it is a true story that he is telling.
What would help me is, what do you mean by carefully crafted? I don't think I understand that concept.
Well, so I think that Matthew is aware, for example, that the way he is telling his story highlights a number of revelatory dreams that God uses to protect the child in various ways. Now, it's true that that happened, but a lot of things happened. But he has chosen to tell the story such that these are sort of milestones along the way. He tells the story such that the language that the angel uses echoes the language of Isaiah. Now, did the angel use exactly those words in announcing it to Joseph? I'm not sure. But Matthew, as the teller of the story, is very well aware when he says what the angel says earlier, that he is about to, a little later in the story, quote Isaiah, which uses the same pattern of language in telling what's happening there. I think that the sorts of allusions that I was talking about, that there are various things that find their way that suggest the story of the Exodus, Egypt, Israel going into Egypt and coming out of Egypt again, that Matthew is well aware that he is weaving into his story because he thinks there is a deliberate echo in what happens to Jesus, in what happened to Israel. Just like later when it comes to the story of the temptations in the wilderness, Matthew is very aware, I think, that Jesus being 40 days in the wilderness and ending up quoting three times from the sermon that Moses gives at the end of Israel's 40 years in the wilderness, he's very aware that there is an intended, what I'm calling, resonance between those things. That God is doing something that he is bringing out by the way he has told his story. That's what I mean. I don't know if that helps, but that's what I mean. I can tell Jack didn't like my answer.
I think it's R.T. France in his commentary points out that Matthew is not writing a history of Jesus. He's not writing the teachings of Jesus.
He's not writing a biography of Jesus. It's a gospel.
Mm-hmm.
And his point there, I think, is that Matthew is trying to do a very specific thing. And what he's trying to do is to show that Jesus' whole life and ministry points to the fact that he was the Messiah and sent for a very specific purpose. And in order to do that, he has crafted, and I think that's a good word for it, he's crafted his presentation in a way that recalls, brings to mind all of these allusions and themes from the Old Testament, and they all point to Jesus. And he could have told it differently. There were a lot of things that he could have told that he didn't tell. He's been very selective. So he's picking out specific things from Jesus' life that he's going to present. He's ignoring the other things. He presents it in a certain way, using certain language that alludes, that calls to mind things that happened in the Old Testament, that he finds resonance between that and in Jesus' life. I'm convinced that the things that you're saying are very true, that Matthew, that stuff is just everywhere. He's woven that in everywhere. And to anyone who's really paying attention to that, you can kind of pick up on the ways in which he has built on Old Testament themes. And I think his point is to say, is he not the Messiah that was predicted in the Old Testament and pointed to by the Old Testament?
Yeah, well, obviously, since you were supporting what I was saying, I'm not going to disagree with you. I've read France. I like France's comments. It centers around this word fulfill, which France emphasizes, he kind of picks that as like the word that characterizes what Matthew is doing. And that's a long discussion. And I'm going to try to talk about that some more next week with these passages that he quoted. But yeah, what I am becoming convinced of is that there is something that Matthew is doing deliberately. That, see, you have to understand, who's the person who first really talked to me in a serious way about hermeneutics and how you interpret the Bible? It's Jack. It's that guy over there. And I remember very well when Jack talked about this stuff, I asked him, the way he interpreted the word fulfill in these passages in the birth narrative, I asked Jack the question. I don't know what you say now, but I know what you said back then. Jack, if it had been that Jesus had been taken to France instead of to Egypt, would Matthew still say that it fulfilled the passage that said, out of Egypt I called my son? And Jack's answer at that point was yes, because the part about Egypt is irrelevant. It's a theological, exegetical connection that Matthew is making to this stuff, not any sort of God has written history such that there are foreshadowings in what happened here to what happened to Jesus. I'm very sympathetic with that way of thinking about things in as much as I look at the history of how the Bible has been interpreted and I see a history filled with uncontrolled, wild speculation on what it is that's going on there. So I can just start seeing stuff everywhere. There's the classic thing about Rahab puts the scarlet cord down for the spies, and of course it's a scarlet cord because it represents the blood of Jesus. And when Moses lifted up his hands for the staff so that the armies could prevail and stuff, of course he lifted up his arms like this. Of course, why did he lift up his arms like that? Because it's the cross and so forth. So that's out there, and I am very, very conservative on that kind of stuff. I'm reluctant to get wild in that way. So I have to find things that convince me that I'm looking at something intentional in what the author is doing. And I am coming to the place that you're talking about, David, where I think Matthew is very well aware of the allusions and things that he is bringing into this. So I am coming to the place where I'm saying, I think I'm seeing Matthew's craftsmanship here. That is his awareness that he thinks God is doing something like that and he's reflecting it in the way that he's telling this story. But I also am, I just think we need to be careful because you end up taking Augustine's approach in half the stuff in the Bible, we don't even pay attention to what it literally says. We turn it into an allegory or something of some other meaning. I just don't want to go there. So that's why I recognize that the sort of thing that I was saying about this here is not the sort of thing that I usually say. But I am becoming convinced that there is such a thing going on. And I will talk about that more next week. And I recognize, let's just be upfront about this. I've looked around at a number of commentaries on Matthew to kind of see what people are saying about various things. And there are a ton of different perspectives on these questions. Something like the birth narrative and the Old Testament allusions and these fulfillment passages, this fulfilled this and this fulfilled this, these are very difficult questions. And people have different answers to how they put this stuff together. So I can't stand up here and say I'm the expert and I'm the one in the entire history of the world who has gotten it right, although that's possible. You want to remember that that's entirely possible. But the best I can do is say I take what Matthew's saying seriously. I believe he's telling the truth about what happened, and yet it is interesting the choices that he has made and how he puts this thing together, and I think there's something going on there. So that's all I would ask you to do, is to just grant the possibility that such a thing might be happening. Okay.
A couple of things. Ever since I was a kid, I always had questions about the star.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, it's not a star like we think of a star.
This is the wrong guy to ask this
well,
question.
Maybe I'm the only one that's ever thought about it, but it seems like it had to be something that only the Magi was aware of or could follow or whatever. Otherwise, there'd be a whole lot of people, it seems like, that would be following that star. Takes them to Jerusalem, and it must shut off because Herod would say, "Where's that star?" And so ever since I was a kid, I was wondering how you follow a star. But my real question is, Matthew and Luke, where did they get their information, and how did they get it? I mean, I always try to think, Mary, okay, sit down, Matthew. I'm going to tell you something, you know, about mm-hmm. virgin birth and mm-hmm. see if you can handle it. It just seems like, how right. do you, and the visions of Joseph and the story that he was, Joseph could have told it to Mary and Mary could have communicated, however it was done, but I just kind of speculate, how did this happen?
Right. Right.
We don't have any clue, I don't think. But
well, we have a little bit of a clue. Not so much for Matthew, but when it comes to Luke, Luke at the beginning describes the process that he went through, that he's interviewing eyewitnesses and so forth. That he says a number of people have written on these things, and I'm going to pull the stuff together, and I've talked to people, and I'm going to tell the story. And then it is very striking that Luke's account centers on Mary. There's a lot of stuff about the announcement to her. Mary, except that she's named a couple of times as the mother of Jesus, she doesn't enter into the story. She enters into it into the fact that she's the virgin who bears a son and calls the name Jesus. But except for that, she doesn't really enter into it. In Luke, she enters into it quite a bit. So there's a real distinct possibility that for Luke, as opposed to Matthew, that Luke may have talked to Mary directly, because he talks about talking to eyewitnesses, and he has a lot about her in the book. So that's a possibility. If the flip side of that is that Matthew did not do that, then where he got his information from, I don't know. We have other questions like that. Where did he get the last group of names in his genealogy? We don't know that either. And so on. So, yeah, so there comes a point at which we don't know, which does allow then people to say, oh, he made it up. He wouldn't have had any way of knowing this stuff. He just made it up. As far as the star is concerned, it all depends how you picture what was going on. Now, see, I would argue that the star is not giving them a lot of information. They didn't look at the star and go, oh, the king of the Jews. If the star had been over there, it would have been the queen of Switzerland or something, but oh, the star's over there, so it's the king of the Jews. I don't think it's like that. They are familiar with the Jewish scriptures. They know about the concept of the Messiah. I could be totally wrong, but I just think that it's interesting that Daniel was himself kind of the leader of the Magi in Babylon, and he has his visions, which are very specific, about a king of the Jews who's going to rule over all the nations, and a timetable kind of for when he's going to come and so forth. So it's interesting to think that those records would have been kept and they would have had a unique interest in that question because of the visions that Daniel had had. And as I said, there were Jews all over Babylon, so and in general in that region, so they could easily be familiar with the Jewish scriptures and probably would have been very interested in them. So all of the stuff about there being a king of the Jews and that doesn't come from the sky. That's something that they know already. What somehow or another they think that they understand the significance of this star. And is it astrology? Is it they read the sky in a certain way and they think, that's a kingly star and it's never been there before. And this is the time that seems to be when we should be looking for the king of the Jews. And there's the star. And that's where it's just really hard to say. And the only thing that makes it sound like the star moved is that thing right at the end when they go out and they follow the star and it stops over the house. That makes it sound like this is more of like a ball of light than a star. But the rest, that for the beginning part of it, it might just have been a star. You can read all sorts of people, astronomers, going back and saying, okay, well, there was this conjunction when these two planets were lined up, and so it would have been bright, or there was a comet that would have come at a certain time, and people try to argue for even dating these events by, oh, that must have been that comet, or that sort of thing. But the problem is we don't know whether it was an event like that or something God just put a big bright light in the sky and they happen to know what it meant. That's, yeah, I don't know the answer to that question. Okay, one more.
I can only speak for my own like development on what you've been talking about, the craftedness of the narrative and how I've, my thought and how that's developed on that. But I think as a kid and young adult, thinking about the Bible, it was handed to me as a child. And I just have always imagined it being handed down to people in its current form, in the way God hands the tablets to Moses, that's how all of it was there, came up to be. But going through Gutenberg and seeing it shook me a little bit to realize just how crafted every historical account we have is. Herodotus, they're all these people sitting down with stacks of information saying, now what do I need to pass on? And if I was to do that with my own life, how I came to Gutenberg and tell the story, there would be things that I'd leave out. And I could take the route of seeing this story that God has woven into my life and picking out things in my childhood. But my experience is not that significant to have anything to relate it to. But then the Messiah is here, and you have all this wealth of stuff in the Old Testament to find the significance to relate it to. And it seems that that is what Matthew has picked up on, that in Jesus' life, we can look at the events in his life, and this like torrent of events in his life, and pick out the ones that seem to be giving us a window into the significance that God has given to this man. And we can be sure that that's the significance. I think Matthew's confident, at least, that he's come to the right conclusion about what the significance is, because he has these passages in the Old Testament informing that. And so he puts those in there, and you can kind of see his thought process on, well, we kind of have to guess in some ways, but have a window onto what he thinks the significance of these events are that he's chosen to. Yeah. So that's how I'm kind of seeing it now too, which is...
Well, as I say, I'm going to talk about this stuff more next week, because I'm going to talk about the three passages that he talks about as being fulfilled in some way in the events that he's talking about, and try to give a little bit of a picture of how I picture Matthew relating to the Old Testament and how he would relate to the Old Testament in this way. And I'm really serious. It's so much easier to teach on the Sermon on the Mount than it is to talk about this stuff. So this is going to be a weary week for me, trying to pull all of this stuff together. So anyway, it's a miracle that this came together this week. So it managed to come together okay. So we'll see how next week does. And then we're moving on to something else.